The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're moving our way through a fast-moving SEP, already into the final week. Had a busy weekend, was able to join in on the fun Saturday evening with Speed Fellowship. Got to talk, what was it, I guess two and a half minutes, as you move right down the line and talk to about 50 or 60 people over the course of an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes. So that was some fun. They had their big dance last night. That's always a big hit. And then, of course, the normal activities during the day. One of them yesterday, by the way, we had 12 of the campers in this very studio, sitting around this desk, in fact. And some of you might have heard the live DJ efforts that they were putting forth between, I think it was 4:30 and 5:30 yesterday afternoon. They had a statement, a pre-prepared statement. This is, you're listening to KPCG, something to that effect. And then they had a little anecdote that they added about their camp experience, something that they have really enjoyed. So that was fun working with them, getting them ready to get behind the mic and to go live on KPCG. They seem to really enjoy that. And some of them have some really nice voices for radio as well. And they're also fairly talented with their writing. I was impressed at how quickly they assembled some good copy for the narration. One comment coming in from Colorado, it says, I just wanted to let you know how glad I am that you're emphasizing writing out the scriptures. I started doing this when I was in high school for my lessons. And when I came into the church, I was surprised to see people with notebooks. It is very different in God's church. In the churches of this world, you go to services and you just sit there. Maybe you take a Bible, but you certainly don't take a notebook. You certainly don't take down notes. And yet he came into the church and noticed it was very different right away. It says, when I first came in, I took the Ambassador College Bible correspondence course with 58 lessons and wrote out all the scriptures. Then when the PCG started, I also took it and wrote out the verses. It says, now it's been several years since I finished it, but I decided to do it again and to write out the verses. It does help me to remember. And of course, that's what we've been emphasizing. Even though there's scriptures in some cases that maybe you've known for years and years and years, and yet it's amazing. If you just go through the exercise again, you'll remember or see things about those verses that maybe didn't stand out before. Shifting gears a little bit, he says also, I also wanted to comment on Celtic Throne. I was so wrapped up in the production. It was over so quickly. It was the best production I've seen so far, and the others were great. I look forward to being able to get a DVD when available. What an excellent job everyone did. I do hope it can reach more of this world. They do need this now. And of course, that's a point we've been making as well, that now more than ever, this world needs hope. This world needs God's truth. You just go from one week to the next. Well, in particular, over the weekend, this weekend in Chicago, 58 wounded, 9 dead. It's just routine. It's just routine. There was a headline out of Peoria. I think 12 shot or wounded. Just gunshots all over the place. There's a headline at Fox News right now about the mobs in Seattle and police being wounded. And it's been going on in Portland for 7-8 weeks. Saw all these disturbing videos yesterday morning on Andy Ngo's Twitter feed. Just hooligans, criminals roaming the streets, smashing out windows. I think one, it was at this courthouse And these Antifa thugs outside just screaming at the officers inside, cursing at them, saying, get out. This is our building. We're taking it over. And here the president offering to send in help. And these far left Democrat mayors, they don't want the help. They want to see their cities ruined. They want to see their cities destroyed. They want to see their cities, the shops and the stores smashed up. I guess they want to see the store owners just abandon their stores and to leave town. All politicized. All of this violence. It's out of control. New York City. You had Mayor de Blasio last week bragging about letting out thousands of criminals, letting them out of prison, and then saying, you know, we're safer because of it. Exactly the opposite is true. And he knows it. In the UK, there's a headline at the Times, police may drop the term Islamist when describing terror attacks. Well, that certainly will make everyone feel safer. Just change the terminology. Pretend like the violence isn't happening. Pretend like the terrorist attacks aren't really terrorist attacks. Just give it a new label. Just call the rioting protests peaceful protests. We've heard all about this summer. It's just peaceful. We have one of our campers from the Minneapolis area. And how sobering and even frightening it was to see her city go up in flames earlier this summer. Just live a little ways down the road from it. And then you have these arrogant liars on TV saying that it's not really happening. The CNN host yesterday, Brian Stelter, he said, well, Portland, they've always had these Antifa movements. No big deal, nothing to worry about. This is just normal. Get used to it. Why should you be alarmed? Why should you worry about this? They just change the terminology. They just tell you that what's happening isn't really happening. Or what isn't happening? It's happening. Police may drop the term Islamist when describing terror attacks. It says the police are looking at dropping the terms Islamist terrorism and jihadis when describing attacks by those who claim Islam as their motive. Even if they come out and say, yes, I'm motivated by Islam, this is the jihad, then the police, our law enforcement, they're not going to say it. I saw a video, too, of this woman who was out there trying to cover up the graffiti, Black Lives Matter, the one right out in front of Trump Tower in New York City. This was a black woman who was out there with black paint trying to cover it over, saying, look, she said something like, Jesus' life matters. We need to fund the police. She's out there supporting the police. And of course, the police are on hand to promptly arrest her and to take her off to jail. Mayor de Blasio will stop the traffic and start a parade as they get out there and paint Black Lives Matter in bright yellow right in front of Trump Tower. But some other citizen comes along and paints over it and just returns the street back to its normal color. And, well, that's a serious offense. Upside down, just like Isaiah 5 says. Just upside down. Calling good evil and evil good. No wonder so many people are intimidated into just going along. Just go along with the crowd. Just don't cause trouble. Don't say anything. Just go along and mind your own business. Well, President Trump, to his credit, at least he's saying something. But he doesn't have much support. He had this interview over the weekend with Chris Wallace, and I think it went on for 30 or 40 minutes. There were bits of it, I guess, that were released Friday. And then Chris Wallace was able to sort of fact check him along the way in the package that he created for yesterday's show, his Sunday show. And much was made. The media loved the fact that when the president said, well, Joe Biden wants to defund the police. And Chris Wallace, I mean, he corrected him right on the spot. And speaking of Chris Wallace, by the way, just the whole tone of this interview and the way they used to just grovel at the feet of Barack Obama, and they just adored him. They were so respectful. It's nothing like that with President Trump. Just the tone, the back and forth, the little put downs, the disrespect. But the president, as you know, has been able to handle himself with those types of reporters. And he went on for something like 40 minutes. It was recorded out in the Rose Garden or outside of the White House. I think it was like 100 degrees when the interview happened. And the president, over the course of this interview, he made the point that, look, if Joe Biden's doing this one-on-one with you right now, he would just wilt under the pressure. And the president didn't do that. He's standing up to the radical left. Now, maybe Chris Wallace isn't the radical left, but he certainly leans to the left. And the president pointed that out, in fact, and said that, well, you're just a Democrat, but that's fine. I'll sit down. I'll talk with you. I'll go back. I'll go on for 40 minutes. And he answered the questions, and he was sharp and succinct with his responses. And there was a point, and of course the media is not going to make anything of this, but there was a point where the president fact-checked Chris Wallace when he talked about the USA having the worst mortality rate in the world for coronavirus. Not true. That's not true. When you look at the number of deaths per million, it's not true. Here's what the president had to say about wearing masks in public, clip one.
Do you regret not wearing a mask in public from the start? And will you consider a national mandate that people need to wear masks?
No, I want people to have a certain freedom, and I don't believe in that, no. And I don't agree with the statement that if everybody wear a mask, everything disappears. Hey, Dr. Fauci said don't wear a mask. Our Surgeon General, terrific guy, said don't wear a mask. Everybody was saying don't wear a mask. All of a sudden, everybody's got to wear a mask. And as you know, masks cause problems, too. With that being said, I'm a believer in masks. I think masks are good. But I leave it up to the governors. Many of the governors are changing. They're more mask into. They like the concept of masks. But some of them don't agree. I do say this. Schools have to open.
So he wants the schools to open. He knows that children are not in danger. But he says they're about the masks. Look, it's a free country. You decide. All these people intimidating others into wearing a mask. When just a couple months ago, as he said there, Fauci himself said it doesn't help. The Surgeon General doesn't help. And now you're seeing more and more of these studies saying how much it hurts. How much bacteria these masks collect. When you take them off so that you can eat, you set them on the counter, you put them on the floorboard of your car, you put them in the glove compartment, then you pull them out and wrap it around your mouth? There's dangers there. All these solutions that men keep putting forward. Fauci, by the way, he's on TV over the weekend talking about how the success of New York in battling this disease. And of course, if you've followed this program at all, you know the truth about Governor Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, and the problem with this virus in New York. In New York, it was the worst in the world. You take away New York and New Jersey, and the United States really hasn't been hit hard by this at all. But New York, listen to what Dr. Fauci said about New York over the weekend, clip 8.
We know that when you do it properly, you bring down those cases. We've done it. We've done it in New York. New York got hit worse than any place in the world, and they did it correctly.
They did it correctly? By sending the sick patients back into the elderly care centers? The March 25th mandate? The decree from King Cuomo? And then he quietly rescinds it about a month later? They did not do it correctly. But here's Fauci, you see. He's a liberal, a far-left liberal Democrat through and through. So he's right along the same line as Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon and all the CNN friends. Andrew Cuomo did, he handled it perfectly. The swamp is deep. The deep state runs deep. There was a story about the CDC from the Daily Caller over the weekend. It says CDC employees made more than 8,000 federal contributions to PACs. That would be political campaigns, basically, or political organizations. They made more than 8,000 contributions to PACs and politicians since 2015. Only five went to Republican causes. How does this happen? These people working at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and 99% of the political contributions go to Democrats, and they only counted five that went to Republicans. This is the federal bureaucracy. You can see what would have happened, as my father has noted, what would have happened had Hillary Clinton won in 2016. It would have been over for the United States. It would have been over. God intervened to save America temporarily. 8,000 contributions and only five went to Republican causes. That's the CDC. They, and Dr. Fauci, all of them, they come from the same group. They all were counting on Hillary Clinton getting in there. You think this disease would be handled the same way if Hillary Clinton's in the White House? It would be very different. The interviews, all of it, would be very different. The tone with Chris Wallace, very different. Here they are going on and on about masks. Wearing a mask. When Fauci himself, you go back to February, you go back to January. Remember how they were criticizing the travel ban? Remember how they were saying masks don't matter? Why is it different today? Well, because you've got a president that they hate, they despise. And they don't want to see things return to normal. They don't want to see the economy recover. So they're using anything and everything that they can to attack, to target this presidency. Here's the president. On the subject of history and statues being pulled down, thugs roaming the street, the effort to cancel our history. This is clip two.
You know, the whole thing with cancel culture, we can't cancel our whole history. We can't forget that the North and the South fought. We have to remember that. Otherwise, we'll end up fighting again.
That's right. We've got to remember. Here's, again, the businessman, Donald Trump, giving us a history lesson that no one else will step forward and give. They're all cowering in fear. They're afraid of the mob. They're afraid they're going to be fired or sacked like David Starkey. So they're just keeping quiet. Here's what the president went on to say, clip three.
Fort Bragg is a big deal. We won two world wars. Nobody even knows General Bragg. We won two world wars. Go to that community where Fort Bragg is, in a great state. I love that state. Go to the community. Say, how do you like the idea of renaming Fort Bragg? And then what are we going to name it? You're going to name it after the Reverend Al Sharpton? What are you going to name it, Chris? Tell me what you're going to name it.
You're going to name it after Al Sharpton? We've got to change Fort Bragg. Don't like the name. We've got to delete the history. We've got to erase it. There was a story again in the UK yesterday. It's from the BBC. I think it's a Nigerian author that's writing about Africa's part or Nigeria's part in the slave trafficking. And this is, again, this is from the BBC website, introducing the article by saying Nigerian journalist and novelist Adewabi Nwabani writes that one of her ancestors sold slaves, but argues that he should not be judged by today's standards or values. Well, we don't want to, we can't judge the Nigerian slave traffickers by today's standards or value, which is exactly what we're doing with our own ancestors. That's why they've got to be canceled. That's why they've got to be deleted. That's why they've got to be erased. It says here in the article that she lived in a, or rather this ancestor in Nigeria, lived in a time when the fittest survived and the bravest excelled. The concept of all men are created equal was completely alien to traditional religion and law in his society. It would be unfair to judge the 19th century man by 21st century principles. And then further on, listen to this, when it gets into Britain's hand in stamping out the practice, stamping out the slave trade, it says about Britain, when the British extended their rule to southeastern Nigeria in the late 19th century and early 20th century, they began to enforce abolition through military action. The slave trade, as this article brings out, it continued all the way up to the late 1800s. I think Brazil was continuing with the slave trafficking, trafficking slaves from Africa to South America. And then Britain, as it expanded its empire, it was eradicating the practice. It was removing this scar, this sin. But listen to the BBC. It says, but by using force rather than persuasion. Many local people, such as my great-grandfather, may not have understood that abolition was about the dignity of humankind and not a mere change in economic policy that affected demand and supply. So even when they talk about Britain doing away with it, they say that Britain should have done it by persuasion and not by force. They should have gone in there and tried to persuade people not to do it. Okay. This is crazy. This is from the BBC. When are they going to treat their own British ancestors this fairly? Well, you can't judge someone from the 19th century by today's standards, by the political correctness of today. And then for the article to suggest that Britain shouldn't have ended it by force? Well, how are you going to end it? Britain and America, as we've noted on this program, Britain and America during the 1800s led the way in canceling this practice, in doing away with this sin. And you look at some of the coverage today, it really and truly is appalling. That's the BBC, switching back to this interview with Chris Wallace. President Trump was asked about the upcoming election in November, and I think he was kind of badgering him. Well, what if you lose? And we heard this in 2016, if you remember. Well, if he loses, he's not going to accept the result. That's un-American. That's never happened. So now they're on to this same questioning. Well, what if you lose to Joe Biden? After all, you're way behind in all the polls. that too was the case in 2016. And then he won. And then it was Hillary Clinton who didn't accept the results. So here they are asking him this again. Asking him again about the polls and about will he accept the results and so on. Clip 4.
First of all, I'm not losing because those are fake polls. They were fake in 2016, and now they're even more fake. The polls were much worse in 2016. They interviewed 22% Republican. Well, how do you do 22% Republican? You see what's going on. I have other polls that put me leading. And we have polls where I'm leading. I have a poll where we're leading in every swing state. And I don't believe that you're, first of all, the Fox polls, whoever does your Fox polls, they're among the worst. They got it all wrong in 2016. They've been wrong on every poll I've ever seen.
So that's the president. He, of late, hasn't been too happy with some of the reporting at Fox. But there he is, sitting down with Chris Wallace, back and forth, 45 minutes, in 100-degree weather. And you can see the moisture, the beads of sweat on the president's face. But he's out there, and his answers were short and crisp, right to the point. What if you lose? Well, I'm not going to lose. Polls are wrong. They were wrong in 2016. He went on to say some of the things that would happen if Joe Biden were to win the election. But then he got to this section. We can skip clip five, fellas. But he got to this section where they asked about his niece, you know, the one that's out on the book tour now that says Donald Trump's a horrible person and his parents were horrible people as well. And to hear the president of the United States here again, you remember the Mount Rushmore speech, just say things that not that long ago, a year or two ago, we would have heard as a country and thought, well, this is exactly right. This is exactly the truth. Here's the president of the United States speaking up for, defending his family, his mother, his father, and some of the things he says about his parents. They're just, well, it's touching. This is clip six.
You've developed a pretty thick skin over the years, from decades of attacks in New York tabloids, now from the press here, and your political opponents here in Washington. But even for Donald Trump, does it hurt you at all to be attacked in such personal terms by a member of your own family?
It hurts me more about attacking my father, not being kind to my mother. I have a mother who was like a saint. She was incredible. She was an incredible woman. And she was nasty even to my mother. She's a very scarred person. She was not much of a family person. But look, let me just tell you, my father was, I think he was the most solid person I've ever met. And he was a very good person. He was a very, very good person. He was strong, but he was good. For her to say the kind of things, a psychopath, that he was a psychopath, anybody that knew Fred Trump would call him a psychopath. And you know what? If he was, I would tell you. And I would say, you know, Chris, I was with my father and it was impossible. My father was, he was tough. He was tough on me. He was tough on all of the kids, but tough in a solid sense, in a really good sense. For her to say, I think the word she used was psychopath. What a disgrace. She ought to be ashamed of herself. That book is a lie.
She ought to be ashamed of herself. She really should. I think she, to be precise, I think she used the word sociopath, but not much different, really. Here she is, just slandering the family. She doesn't even know him that well. She comes along with her book. Now, she wasn't writing this in 2015. It's just yet another attempt to make a quick buck, to get her 15 seconds of fame. But I loved what he said about his mother. She was like a saint. And his father, Fred Trump, the most solid person I've ever met. That's someone who has a deep respect for and honor for his parents. And of course, he's been very, very quick to rise in defense of his children as well. It's, you know, for all of his baggage, for all of his weaknesses with women and such over the years, it is pretty remarkable that he's managed to keep his family intact. Obviously, he's had his wives, I forget how many, but the children seem pretty loyal and they seem to love him. But the love he has for his parents and what they did for him, that's to hear someone talk about his parents that way. That too is unusual today. You just don't hear it. Well, he said a few other things about I guess I can play this one, too. It gets into the deep state and how he was treated in the lead up to the campaign in 2016. And you might have heard from Mark Meadows over the weekend where he talked about more and more documents being revealed, suggesting that perhaps it's finally going to come down on some of these Marxist radicals who were spying on the Trump campaign from the very beginning. But anyway, on this point about the attack on his campaign back in 2015 and 16, the spying and the attack that continued on into his presidency. Here's what the president had to say, clip 7.
I think I was very unfairly treated. From before I even won, I was under investigation by a bunch of thieves, crooks. It was an illegal investigation.
But what about the good part, sir?
No, I want to go this. I have done more than any president in history in the first 3.5 years, and I've done it suffering through investigations where people have been, General Flynn, where people have been so unfairly treated. The Russia hoax, it was all a hoax. The Mueller scam, it was all a scam. It was all false. I made a bad decision on one bad decision, Jeff Sessions. And now I feel good because he lost overwhelmingly in the great state of Alabama. Here's the bottom line. I've been very unfairly treated. And I don't say that as paranoid. I've been very, everybody says it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens, but with tremendous evidence right now as to how unfairly treated I was. President Obama and Biden spied on my campaign. It's never happened in history. If it were the other way around, the people would be in jail for 50 years right now. That would be Comey. That would be Brennan. That would be all of this, the two lovers, Strzok and Page. They would be in jail now for many, many years. They would be in jail. It would have started 2 years ago, and they'd be there for 50 years. The fact is, they illegally spied on my campaign. Let's see what happens. Despite that, I did more than any president in history in the first 3.5 years.
Despite all of that, and you, of course, you could add to it all that we've seen happen this year, the way that this pandemic has been politicized, the Black Lives Matter movement, using the George Floyd death as a pretext to destroy cities, to overturn the government, to cancel the United States, to cancel America. That's the aim. Despite all of that, as he said there, he has had a long list of accomplishments, and he hopes for more if he's reelected. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a short study on the nation's first president, George Washington. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. The relatively new science of archaeology, the digging up and study of the material remains of man's past, has confirmed without question the historical accuracy of the Bible. Solid, documented evidence, apart from the Bible, confirms events and persons that at one time were known to us only from Scripture. The Bible is real, and you need to pay attention to it. Call now and request your free copy of The Authority of the Bible. This lesson, which comes from the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, blows the dust off your Bible. You will learn how to mine the treasures buried in the greatest book on earth. You can discover its secrets and enrich your life today. For more information, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Throughout our summer educational program, we've been drawing attention, quite a lot of attention, to the founders of the United States and pointing to their outstanding character traits. So many of these individuals were God-fearing men and women, deeply religious, And then they were also men and women of action. Men and women. I prepared some material for this morning's forum on Theodore Roosevelt. This man was a man of action. This man had a lot to do with turning the United States into a superpower. And now you've got people like Mayor de Blasio saying we got to pull down his statue. He had some disturbing weaknesses. He was a complex individual, and yeah, there's a lot of things about him that I don't really like. The whole focus, as President Trump pointed out at Mount Rushmore, is on the negative. The whole focus is on this flaw or that flaw, and they just concentrate on it, and they find more and more weaknesses or flaws, or what they perceive to be flaws. And then before you know it, well, we're at that point now. Cancel. You've got to cancel. Now, if they're in Nigeria, we certainly don't want to hold them to today's standards. But if these are American patriots, or if these were ordinary British citizens or extraordinary ones, we've got to erase that history. George Washington said at his inaugural address in 1789, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Private morality. That's how we have to develop our national policy. Our national policy needs to flow out from a Bible-based private morality. The two go together. And speaking of a president who honored and respected his parents, his dad died, I think, when he was 9 or 10. And George had to grow up fast. But throughout his life, he had such a love and respect for his mother. He addressed her as my revered mother. Like I said, President Trump, for him to say that my mother was like a saint. It's unusual. President Washington said or referred to his mom at times as honored madam. Honored madam. He's the first American president, as we know. He was a national hero because of how he courageously led the Patriots, the troops, in the Revolutionary War. A national hero. It was, I think, unanimous, the support for him in the Constitutional Convention. The support he received for heading up the military, and then later for becoming president. And here, last month, you have all these Antifa, BLM thugs out on the streets, these agitators pulling down a statue of George Washington. They spray painted it with the words colonist. They spray painted Black Lives Matter on it. They actually wrapped this statue in an American flag, burned the flag, and then pulled down the statue. I remember a program last year where I think it was someone that was walking through the campus, George Washington University, suggesting to these students that the name be changed. And all the students going to George Washington University, we're just nodding in agreement. Well, yeah, actually, we probably should change the name. And that seemed so crazy back then, but that's the thinking on campuses today. And now we see that thinking on every street in America, it seems like. I've mentioned this quote before by the president and CEO of Washington's Mount Vernon estate. He said that without George Washington, there would be no United States of America. There would be no Constitution, which allows the freedom of speech, assembly, and protest. He said, if we fail to honor George Washington because we understand him only as a slave owner, We will lose the story of the United States, for it will have no beginning and very little direction. If we fail to honor him, George Washington, we have no history. We have no story. We have no story to pass along to our children. You can look at the Mount Vernon website where it says Washington left directions for the emancipation of all the slaves that he owned after the death of his wife, Martha. It says she decided to free her late husband's slaves early, and the process was finally complete in 1801. So that's just a bit of history that you're obviously not going to hear in the coverage today. The only thing they'll note is that at a time he was a slave owner, and for that reason he should be canceled. He needs to be judged by the standards of today, by the political correctness of today, by the radical leftist standards of today. That's what he needs to be judged by and sentenced. Joel Hilliker gave a lecture a few years ago about how a lot of the founders knew slavery was a sin and they wanted to get rid of it. And there were a lot of challenges to do that. The Constitution, I mean, they wrote this Constitution, this document, without slavery enshrined in it. But as we know, they did tolerate it in the South. They wanted to contain it. Many of them wanted to get rid of it. It wasn't until the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, that finally did happen. But that's not the only story in America. America was not set up and established, as Mike Pompeo said last week, as a nation set up just strictly to put people in bondage. In David McCullough's book, 1776, he said Washington was one of those rare few who under fire was without fear. He was a man of courage, like that CEO of the estate says. If not for Washington, there'd be no America. That's the truth. McCullough, the historian, he says Washington was not a brilliant strategist or tactician, not a gifted orator, not an intellectual. He didn't really have much formal schooling. It says at several crucial moments, he had shown marked indecisiveness. He had made serious mistakes in judgment. But experience had been his great teacher from boyhood. And in this, his greatest test, he learned steadily from experience. Above all, Washington never forgot what was at stake, and he never gave up. Without Washington's leadership and unrelenting perseverance, the revolution almost certainly would have failed. It would have failed without his leadership. And he wasn't a perfect man. Even McCullough brings out he made his mistakes. He wasn't perfect, but he stayed the course. He learned from his mistakes. And he led the United States to victory. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, if you read his autobiography, if you read other things that he wrote over the years, he talked about the impact that these founders had on his thinking. He studied Ben Franklin's autobiography multiple times. He says in the autobiography that he read through biographies about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt. These are three of the individuals on Mount Rushmore. And then he talks about the great men and women of the Bible that he studied. God wants us to be grounded in this history regarding the Bible and these heroes of the Bible and, of course, the teachings of God. Moses said in Deuteronomy 6, starting in verse 6, it says, "And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You better teach this to your children. You better be diligent. And of course, they weren't just whitewashing away all the flaws and the sins. 1 Corinthians 10 says that all of it's there as an example for us, the good and the bad. It's there for us to learn from. Verse 8 says, "And you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes." See, God knows just how quickly we forget. And so he says, look, make use of every help that you have in order to remember. And that's the point that the president made with Chris Wallace. Look, we can't just cancel it out. We have to remember this history so we don't make the same mistakes. So we don't end up in a civil war again. And that's where it's headed. That's where we're headed. Bind them for a sign upon your hand. Exactly the opposite of the cancel culture. Here's God saying, look, carve it into your thinking. Never forget. Never forget, in the case of American history, if you study into the lives of these founding fathers and, of course, America's founding documents, the essays, the letters, the speeches, boy, you see a lot of wonderful traits. You see a lot of character. You see leadership in the midst of severe trial and test. Like in the case of George Washington. This is what President Trump had to say in that 4th of July speech at Mount Rushmore about America's first president. This is clip 11.
From head to toe, George Washington represented the strength, grace, and dignity of the American people. From a small volunteer force of citizen farmers, he created the Continental Army out of nothing and rallied them to stand against the most powerful military on earth. Through 8 long years, through the brutal winter at Valley Forge, through setback after setback on the field of battle, he led those patriots to ultimate triumph. When the army had dwindled to a few thousand men at Christmas of 1776, when defeat seemed absolutely certain, he took what remained of his forces on a daring nighttime crossing of the Delaware River. They marched through 9 miles of frigid darkness, many without boots on their feet, leaving a trail of blood in the snow. In the morning, they seized victory at Trenton. After forcing the surrender of the most powerful empire on the planet, at Yorktown, General Washington did not claim power, but simply returned to Mount Vernon as a private citizen.
He simply returned to Mount Vernon as a private citizen. He did the same thing after his presidency. 2 terms, 8 years. And he just went home. He went back to Mount Vernon. I think it was King George III that said, if he just turns and walks away from that position of power, he's got to be the greatest leader in the world. But with respect to his leadership at that turning point, as the president described there, crossing the Delaware and then finally seizing victory at Trenton, and the tide of the war begins to change, Nathaniel Green said about Washington's influence, "His Excellency George Washington never appeared to so much advantage as in the hour of distress. That's when he really would shine. When there was a distressing trial to go through." That's because he was a man of character. He stayed the course. And many stayed the course with him. A lot of them abandoned him too. during those conditions at Valley Forge and elsewhere. But said one, Colonel William Tudor, about Washington, "I cannot desert a man, and it would certainly be desertion in a court of honor, who has deserted everything to defend his country, and whose chief misfortune, among 10,000 others, is that a large part of it wants spirit to defend itself." There was a lot of weakness, a lot of cowardice. A lot of people wanted to surrender. They didn't want to fight for their freedom. Washington did. David McCullough wrote that John Hancock said that the victory at Trenton was all the more extraordinary given that it had been achieved by men broken by fatigue and ill fortune. He single-handedly led them to victory. A lot of them had already given up and quit. McCullough says, "From the last week of August to the last week of December, the year 1776 had been as dark a time as those devoted to the American cause had ever known. Indeed, as dark a time as any in the history of the country. And suddenly, miraculously, it seemed, that had changed because of a small band of determined men and their leader." It changed suddenly, and McCullough even says, miraculously, it seemed. As I've been saying to the campers, when you bring God into it, when you see God's hand, that's when the history really does come alive. That's when it gets exciting. That's when you want to delve into it and learn a little bit more about it. Here's one more clip from what President Trump had to say about George Washington at Mount Rushmore, clip 12.
"When called upon again, he presided over the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and was unanimously elected our first president. When he stepped down after two terms, his former adversary, King George, called him the greatest man of the age. He remains first in our hearts to this day. For as long as Americans love this land, we will honor and cherish the father of our country, George Washington." He will never be removed, abolished, and most of all, he will never be forgotten.
Never forgotten. So much that we can take away from this man's leadership, George Washington's character. There was an article in 2011. It quoted this historian writing about George Washington. It says, "Far from coveting power, he spoke of becoming president as the event which I have long dreaded." Again and again, Washington left his beloved Mount Vernon to promote the well-being of his fellow citizens and the idea of self-government. In other words, he was a servant, servant leadership. It says further on, "Why should we so undervalue this great man?" This is an article from 2011. Today, his statues are being trashed. "Why should we so undervalue this great man, without whom our nation might have foundered at its birth? Perhaps it's because we, the beneficiaries of his virtue and self-sacrifice, have largely forgotten the importance of character." That's the real problem. We've forgotten the importance of character. And that's really what the target is, as I've said to the campers over and again. It's not the mistakes and the sins of the past that these agitators are trying to delete. They're trying to delete the character. They're trying to delete the positives. They're trying to delete the glory in this history. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you want to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.